Bob Hicks, sitting in today for Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection. The biggest news of this political season may just be the way the internet is changing politics. Pro wrestler turned governor Jesse Ventura was the first to use the web more than a campaign button, and other candidates have noticed. A state-of-the-art website is one mark of a serious campaign, and a quarter of Americans online are checking out their candidates in cyberspace before casting their votes. For citizens, websites can offer the most direct access to a candidate's views and positions. For the candidates, the internet is a way of reaching voters directly, attracting volunteers, and pulling in a lot of cash. Bill Bradley and John McCain have already raised hundreds of thousands of dollars through their websites. The web may be the booster shot American civil discourse needs. The web is becoming America's town hall, the street corner, the hottest news source. Americans are sharing ideas, following links to interesting articles, and listening to debates online. It looks like the next new thing is cyber voting. States like Arizona and Idaho will be trying it this year in their Democratic primaries. We're talking about virtual politics this hour. Connection listeners, have you looked up your favorite presidential candidate on the web yet? Have you ever ventured into a political chat room or through a political portal? 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK, makes the online politics connection. Jacob Weisberg joins us today from a studio in New York. He's chief political correspondent for Slate Magazine. Also joining us by phone this hour is Kurt Ehrenberg, founder and managing editor of AboutPolitics.com, and Phil Madsen, the webmaster mind behind Jesse Ventura and Donald Trump. And Phil Madsen, we're going to start with you. How are you?
Fine, Bob.
Give us the overview, if you would, the big picture. How did the Ventura web operation work? What was its purpose, and what was your role?
Well, I was the webmaster in the Ventura campaign. Our purpose was simply to use the internet to produce volunteers, money, and votes in support of Jesse Ventura and his running mate, Mae Schunk.
Break each of those areas down. What did you do to achieve those goals, first of all, for volunteers?
Well, the first thing is you need to have a place where people can sign up. Getting them to come to the website itself is really the first step, but that's relatively easy in a political campaign because your political websites, your candidate websites are published widely by the media. Once they're there, you need to give them a reason to stay, and that's by interesting content. And then you also give them a place where they can sign up. Those that want to get involved with the campaign, have a connection with the campaign, you create a form where they leave their names and addresses, and then you service that list by providing them with updates on an ongoing basis.
Now, well, how did you first reach out to people to let them know about Jesse Ventura so that they'd come to the website to begin with?
Well, like I said, you get a lot of support from the press itself. It's fairly typical nowadays to see major newspapers do reviews of websites on the internet itself, too. There's a lot of political portals out there that are now competing to be the first place that people go to get their political information, and they all list the websites. So anybody that uses the internet to acquire political information will usually have it pretty easy to find an easy way to find the candidate sites.
How did the fundraising aspect work?
And I should mention, too, there are a lot of candidates that work hard to push, to get their message out and get people to come. You know, they use banner ads. They will buy ads in the newspapers. They'll put up billboards to get people to come to their sites. And we did some of that. We put our website address on every poster we did, every campaign banner, every brochure, every mailing, all was included in the website. So you're constantly doing what you can to get your name out there.
And the fundraising?
The fundraising? Well, their Jesse Ventura t-shirts proved to be a pretty popular item, and we were basically selling t-shirts online. Additionally, we would ask people to contribute money. Minnesota has a program where up to $50 of your contribution will be refunded to you by the state. All candidates are eligible for that, so we promoted that heavily on the internet as well.
And I would assume same for the volunteers. Once they find it, once they like what they see, getting volunteers to go certain places or do certain things must be somewhat fairly easy.
Well, it is if you've got the right candidate. Now, the governor's opponents were boring. And they also had, being Democrats and Republicans, they had political consultants that were quite arrogant. So they would have a hard time mobilizing volunteers at the grassroots level like Ventura did. Ventura had a real genuine connection with the people that was created, in person, over the air, through the newspapers, and on the internet as well. So, we had a good relationship with the people to begin with. So when we call on volunteers, they would show up big time. But the internet gave us the ability to communicate with these people in a way that it was never available before. And unlike the Democrats and Republicans that had a lot of money, we did not. We did not have an established field force. So using the Internet to communicate with people with whom we had developed a good relationship enabled us to mobilize volunteers in a way that really hadn't been seen in Minnesota before.
What kind of traffic did you get?
I think it's been a while now, but I believe we had about 2 million hits total through the course of the campaign. We started the site in February of 98, and I think by Election Day, we were at about 2 million hits. And I'd say about two-thirds of those came in the 3 weeks before and after the election.
And what did they seem to want, the potential voters, or at least the curious, seem to want when they, the information, when they came looking at your website?
They were remarkably consistent through the whole deal. They had, it's like they came in with two major questions, and that was simply, who is this guy, and where does he stand on the issues? They want to know about the candidate, and they want to know about the public policy positions that the candidate maintains. And I maintain to this day that if a webmaster addresses those two issues, you have taken care of about 80% of what you should do on a website.
And there was some interesting, more local-oriented questions that people raised, too, weren't there? I mean, how do I get my pothole fixed, that sort of thing?
Not particularly. It was a statewide race, and we didn't get many pothole questions. Another example, I guess, of how we did use it locally and specifically and quickly, the governor was quoted, when he was a candidate, Jesse was quoted, misquoted on a prostitution question. And it was said that he favors prostitution. And in fact, at that event, they asked him the question, and his answer was absolutely not. But the Democrats and Republicans took the misquote and ran with it once it was published in the paper. We were able to immediately put a message out to our supporters, and we had about 3,000 of them statewide at that point, telling them what the exact quote was. And then they had in their hands then our press release indicating the truth. And instantly we had basically 3,000 truth-telling missionaries on the ground statewide, and we were able to kill that rumor right off the bat before it was able to damage Ventura.
In just a day or so, as I recall reading.
That's right. So that was, you know, it was those types of uses. It wasn't so much, you know, having a discussion about potholes. People want to know where the governor stands on the issues, but the dynamic part of the website for us was the interaction between the volunteers and the candidate.
As I also read, the Ventura campaign rejected the notion that it shouldn't be detailing policy positions. In fact, the website went into great detail about policy, and thus it helped in large part to deflect the notion that Jesse was all body and no substance.
Well, that's true. We had there was a point in the campaign when the newspaper was doing a profile of the different websites. And they named Jesse, it was Jesse the Body Ventura, now it's Jesse the Wonk Ventura, indicating that he has policy issues of substance up. Prior to that point, people were saying he's not a serious candidate, but when they started seeing serious policy positions posted on the website, that did help shape the governor's image in the public mind.
Let's bring Jacob Weisberg into the conversation here, chief political correspondent for Slate Magazine. He's joining us from a studio in New York. Good morning.
Thanks for having me on, Bob. If I can just flatter you for a minute, one of the nice things about covering the campaign up in New Hampshire is I get to listen to The Connection, which I just think is a terrific program.
Oh, thanks very much, and Chris Lydon thanks you as well. He's off for a couple of days. He'll be back in a few. Let me ask you, Jacob, if I can, first of all, looking back at the Ventura campaign and the Ventura web operation, what did it do from your point of view that was correct?
Well, the reason I think what Phil Madsen did, the Ventura campaign, was groundbreaking is basically because that was the first campaign to take the web seriously. And it's not so much any specific thing they did. In fact, I think it's very hard to measure what effect the Internet had on Ventura's campaign, whether he would have won or wouldn't have won without it. But it was the fact that they were exploring this new medium in the way all campaigns are trying to do now. One of the most interesting things to me about it was something I don't think Phil mentioned, which was the way they used their website to create a virtual campaign. That is, I think when Governor Ventura was on his bus tour campaigning, you could follow the progress of the bus and what he was saying at various stops with pictures posted on the web. And that's really one of the things I think that allows people to participate in a campaign without actually being there. It's part of what's so appealing about the medium.
It's joining the campaign from your armchair, so to speak. You don't have to go out and stand outside a town hall or stand outside a high school in the cold in New Hampshire to find out what the candidate is saying.
but in a couple different respects from television. For one, it's not as passive. You're not just waiting to be fed whatever information the media decides you should have. And secondly, the level of detail. As Phil Madsen said, you can get this wealth of information about the policy proposals. You can really get into the campaign in a level of specificity that you can't watching television.
1-800-423-TALK, 1-800-423-8255. Connection listeners, are you connected to the candidates via the web? Do you believe it adds to the political dialogue, especially during this political season? Today, we're 1 week away from the Iowa caucuses, and 8 days after that comes the first in the nation presidential primary in New Hampshire. What's your view on this? Jacob, what are the presidential candidates doing right and doing wrong in this campaign via their websites?
Well, it's a period of exploration right now, and I would say that all the campaigns are intrinsically conservative in the sense that they're not sinking vast resources into the web until they feel that it's more proven. In fact, I was a little surprised that web advertising, for example, was so long in coming. We've just started to see the first banner ads on the web in the last few weeks.
And where are they to be found?
Well, there are three candidates who've done them, Bush, McCain, and Bradley. And interestingly, they've all had different strategies, different approaches to this. Bush has gone with fairly conventional, well, you shouldn't say conventional because they're internet ads, but interactive ads that have focused particularly on New Hampshire and Iowa, highlighting the issues that Bush thinks will be important to voters in those states. He has an anti-tax message in New Hampshire. And then McCain did something a little more novel and interesting, I think. He tried to use his web advertising as a tool for recruiting volunteers in Virginia, where he needed to get on the ballot. He needed people to help him get signatures. And he asked, with a relatively small buy, but he asked people who saw this ad to volunteer. And they had a surprising response to that. I think they said something like 2% of the people who saw the ad clicked on it. But of that, nearly half actually ended up volunteering and helping McCain gather signatures. Bradley has had yet another strategy. Sorry, just to finish, he's done a bulk buy on Hotmail. So he's targeting users of Hotmail, not just in the early primary states, but I believe around the country.
Are they advertising on the home page of these services, or are they emailing advertisements right to people's own PCs?
Well, again, they're all doing something slightly different, but the most innovative and in some ways alarming thing is that they're able to focus on the viewers they want very narrowly by using demographic and marketing data collected by some of these websites and then targeting ads to, say, women under 35 in New Hampshire who are likely Republican voters. And they do the last by comparing the marketing data from the websites with voter lists. So a web banner can be targeted directly to you, and it looks to you like a random advertisement that anybody on this website would see. But in fact, it's been specially selected based on your demographic characteristics. I think there's some privacy issues there.
Phil Madsen, still with us. You're at the moment working for Donald Trump.
Yes.
And what are you doing for Mr. Trump?
Well, right now, one of the things I'm doing is debating whether or not banner ads would serve the campaign or not. With the Ventura campaign, the decision was kind of made for us because we had very little money to work with, and we had to maximize every dollar. Donald Trump has not yet declared that he's a candidate, but he has said he's expected to make the decision by mid-February. But he has said that if he does run, he's willing to spend up to $100 million in on the race, which would probably give me a pretty good banner ad budget if we chose to use it. But I'm reluctant to use banner ads.
Why?
Because this notion of targeting and using very demographically precise databases and so on, you run the risk of falling victim to your own arrogance. You run the risk of assuming that you know what's going on out there and that you know who your market is. Had we taken that approach with Ventura, we probably would have lost the election. What we did in building the Ventura site and the approach that we took, I just put up a very basic web page, and as people asked me to add features, I went ahead and did it. As people asked for different things, we responded, and we let the people come to us. We did not go out buying lists and using highly sophisticated marketing strategies. And you might notice that 16% of the people who voted in Minnesota's election were new voters. People who hardly ever voted before or had never voted came to the polls to vote for Jesse Ventura. And that's a demographic that would never show up on these sophisticated databases.
So there's a big game in town right now in Washington about all these wonderful demographic tools and database this and that and the other thing, and they're very pricey, banner ad strategies that are guaranteed to make your candidate the next emperor. But I'm skeptical, and again, that marketing approach, you run the risk of falling victim to your own arrogance.
Phil Madsen, forgive me if I don't understand this, or if I'm not quite getting this. Is anyone taking the approach yet that an individual candidate, Donald Trump or anyone else, can and should email an individual an ad at the home address? Fill in the blank, John Smith at AOL.com.
Only if the individual has given you permission to do so. Sending unsolicited emails out to people is unethical, and it's certain death for a candidate's popularity.
John, just to clarify a minute, Bob, it is confusing. There are two separate things we're talking about here. What I was talking about was not email. It was actually banner ads that are targeted very carefully to users of specific websites. Email is another thing entirely, although it is another technique that campaigns are in some cases experimenting with.
Phil Madsen, thanks very much for joining us on The Connection today, and good luck with the Donald Trump campaign should he decide to get in mid-February.
Well, thank you, Bob. It was a lot of fun.
Let's bring to the conversation now Kurt Ehrenberg, founder and managing editor of AboutPolitics.com. Kurt, thanks for being on The Connection today.
Hey, Bob, that's politics.com. Not about politics, but it's politics.com.
And sorry about that. We'll get that.
Okay.
We'll get that address correct.
It's a pleasure to be with you, and it's a pleasure to be with Jacob, someone I read all the time. And I'm in New Hampshire, and it's cold up here today.
and wouldn't you rather be sitting in your house following the campaign?
Well, it's more fun that way. That's why I do it, because I do live in New Hampshire. So I bring that perspective to the campaign as to what the real New Hampshire people actually do think, not folks sitting in New York telling you what people in New Hampshire think. But that's a whole other issue. I think one thing that's been missed so far in the show is the fun aspect of politics on the Internet. One thing about the Internet is that it's fun, and it's something that gives people what they want, or they don't use that particular site or that aspect of the Internet. It's something that people go to amuse and inform themselves. And the promise of the Internet is that you can go there quickly, easily, find out information that you want to find out quickly, whether it's about a candidate or buying a car. And what we hope to do at politics.com, and I think there are many other sites, including candidate sites, that are trying to do this, is to cater to people's Internet sort of intuition, which is, you go to a website, you look at it, and you quickly find out whether it's useful to you or not. You can find out who gave money to candidates. You can do that on politics.com and many other websites. You can find out where a candidate's going to be today. If you're living in New Hampshire or Iowa, you can track the candidates and go out and see them. I think that's one thing. It's sort of like bringing politics to people as a spectator sport, as something that they will become more closely involved with, just because it's simple and easy to do.
And you mentioned the word fun. What makes it fun from your point of view?
Well, I think people like me who've been involved in politics all their life, sort of as an avocation, working on campaigns and just sort of observing the political landscape and watching like you would a spectator sport. I think if you go to politics.com, you'll see that we treat politics that way. It's a serious business. But at the same time, it's something that people like to observe. It affects their lives, but it's also very, very enjoyable for people. And I think the Internet is just a whole other medium for people to use. I mean, who would have thought 20 years ago that you'd have four or five all-news channels covering this campaign as closely as they are?
Let's find out what Connection listeners are saying about campaign.com. 1-800-423-TALK, 1-800-423-8255. Eric, you're on The Connection. Thanks for calling.
Hey, I wanted, and up to now, it seems like you guys have talked a lot about the top-down nature, say, come from the ads or the candidates' websites. But I think some of the best information I've got was on a discussion group with other, you know, yo-yos like me, really.
What interests you?
Well, we had talked about the with a campaign discussion group around the election, and we talked about, you know, Bill Bradley, his health plan. And then we all had at the same time doubts at the same time. And what we did was we started to look not at just the campaign websites and not just the news sites, but the independent sources of information. We could pass that around, the studies that we found on the web and the stuff that wasn't behind advocating one candidate or another. Because you look at a campaign website and automatically you're skeptical.
Right. So where do you go to find the trusted information that you would rely on?
Really, we would, we're with a lot of people and they all have, you know, pretty honest doubts about, like, the Bradley health plan. Can it work? Are they being honest? And so a lot of times you have to go to a search engine and start to look up studies that have done by foundations and stuff like that, like the RAND Foundation, RAND Corporation, or somebody like that. And that's where you really start to get into meaty discussions about what these numbers mean and what's the difference between a premium and a cost, and is this going to work or not? You know, are they being honest or not? And is it good to be honest or not? You know,
Jacob Weisberger, do you follow these conversations and are they important?
Yes, I think the caller touches on a very important point, a very interesting point, which is the way that the internet, and I say this as a journalist who works on the internet, starts to erase the difference between journalists and citizens. In a way, anyone can be a journalist on the internet, either by participating in one of these discussion groups and communicating with what might be a smallish number of people, or by setting up their own website, which suddenly says in cyberspace it becomes very inexpensive and very easy, relatively speaking, to start your own publication. And a number of people have done that just for purposes of commenting on the campaign. In terms of the discussion group, I'm busy writing Slate's coverage of the campaign. I haven't had a lot of time to write private messages, but I do keep track of them, and in particular I keep track of the one that goes on Slate's page, which is called The Fray, which has at times, I think, very high level discussion and analysis of the campaign.
It strikes me that it's a way that the voters, instead of the opposing candidates, can truth squad the candidates, so to speak. You're coming close to the point in history where you won't be able to say something in one state and say something different in another state on the same subject.
Oh, I think we're there, don't you? I think the internet clearly has brought us that. If nothing else, we're at that point where news is instantaneous. Everyone has the AP wire on their desktop if they want it. At politics.com, we have daily news. We have these forums that you've been talking about where people can go and chat. Right now, we've got a dozen live as we speak. People can start their own web page there. So I think we're at that point now. It's just a question of people will use it as they see fit. I think clearly, as usual, the candidates are lagging behind the people. They're fighting the last war, and that will continue. I think one thing, when we talk about banner advertising, when you're in primary mode and you can target, like Jacob was saying, a housewife in New Hampshire who uses a certain website every day because she has her cookies on her machine turned on. These various websites know the kind of person she is, maybe knows her buying patterns, etc., and can very easily target an ad to her from Bradley or McCain to women about an issue that they know through their polling and through their focus groups is extremely important to women at this point in time. Better even than a direct mail piece might have been before. When you have a very small universe of people who you're trying to target, the closer you can know that person, the better off you are. And that's why you will see those kinds of ads proliferating, I think, as, you know, people are online and connections get faster and the technology catches up.
Jacob Weisberger?
Well, one of the reasons that alarms me a little bit, Kurt, is because these kinds of ads, and I don't say it's a totally negative development. In some ways, I think these ads are a positive development, but they're not subject to the kinds of regulation that other advertising is in politics, partly because they're a new invention. But if these ad buys were ad buys on television, the books of the television station would be open, and I'd be able to find out how much money the Bush campaign was spending, and I'd be able to make sure that WMUR New Hampshire was charging the same rate to George Bush that they were charging to Steve Forbes. And on the Internet, there are no rules like that that apply, partly because the FCC doesn't seem to have the power to apply the same regulations. But it's possible, for example, that one of the big websites like AOL or Yahoo could offer to sell a product that would really be kind of discriminatory and unfair. They could sell not just sell advertising of Republican housewives in New Hampshire to one candidate, but they could offer to sell all of their advertising of that kind to one candidate at a premium price.
You're right, and without regulation, they could make they could make bulk rate prices available to George W. Bush, who has millions of dollars to spend. And when Gary Bauer goes to them, they say, "Well, Gary, you can only buy 10 ads, so they're, you know, four times as much." And that's the job for the Federal Election Commission. And we saw earlier in this campaign season when Bill Bradley asked the Federal Election Commission to allow him to take money online that could then be used as other monies collected by check would be against his federal matching funds.
Mm-hmm.
And they changed the regulation, and that had opened, now has opened the floodgates for fundraising online, and everyone seems to think that's just fine.
Let me interrupt here to say that we'll continue the conversation on the other side of the break about campaign2000.com, the candidates, and the web. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston and PRI, Public Radio International.
Funding for The Connection comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and from the Allaire Corporation, empowering people with innovative internet technology and offering dynamic career opportunities at Allaire.com. From Boston.
I'm Bob Oak, sitting in for Christopher Lydon today. This is The Connection. This is the online politics question today. How are the candidates and the potential voters, how they're using the web this election cycle, or so far during this election cycle, and where it's likely to go from here? 1-800-423-TALK, 1-800-423-8255 is the number to join us. Jacob Weisberg is on the line with us today. He's the chief political correspondent for Slate Magazine, and Kurt Ehrenberg is founder and managing editor of politics.com. Jacob, let me start the second half by asking you something very specific about how one of the candidates is trying to use the web this season, John McCain, to try and get on the New York ballot.
Yes, well, I pointed out what he was doing with his advertising and trying to get on the Virginia ballot, and it was actually very helpful there because he lined up a lot of volunteers. And I actually think that's one of the best things you can do with the Internet, because what it does is it encourages real participation. I mean, not virtual participation, not passive participation, but people going out and being involved in a campaign the old-fashioned way, which a lot of people want to do, and they don't know how. And when they're contacted by email or through web advertising, it's another avenue into that. I think McCain is going to try to do the same thing in New York. It's a much harder road to hoe, though, because New York has these really antediluvian ballot access laws that say you need a vast number of signatures and you have to get on the ballot separately in each of New York's 30-something counties. And then the state establishment has a habit of challenging all of your petitions, and because the Governor Pataki and the Republican Party as a whole are supporting George W. Bush, they're going to be very aggressive probably in challenging McCain's petition. So I don't know that even the help he'll get from web volunteers is going to be sufficient to overcome that obstacle.
If I can make one observation about the candidates' websites, and I visited several of the major candidates' websites in this last few weeks, a lot longer than that, but specifically in the last couple of weeks, getting ready for the New Hampshire primary and the Iowa caucuses. One of the things that I liked about John McCain's website is that it was very, very easy to find out where he was going next, and not so much for George W. Bush in relation to potential voters trying to meet him on the campaign trail.
Maybe McCain's got a better idea of where he's going. But I think that, you know, one thing that Phil Madsen tried to get around was whether the web helped them win, and I think the answer is clearly yes. And when you have a candidate like Jesse Ventura, and I think to some extent John McCain and Bill Bradley, who is not a mainstream party candidate who is sort of outside of the regular party apparatus. That the more you bring in people who are also feeling somewhat alienated from that party apparatus, and I think the campaign finance reform issue is big, and all of those sort of reform party issues that Ventura ran on, those are the kinds of people who are attracted to candidates over the internet, who that get involved over the internet rather than the older ways. And I think one other point, when talking about the New York primary system and those antiquated laws where the party bosses get to shut out candidates, et cetera, the internet as a fresh way of going about doing things in life will prompt people to, I think, take these laws and get rid of them quickly and move towards a system where people can really participate over the internet in the future in terms of actual voting. And I think that's something that we'll see sooner rather than later. I think people will be surprised that they'll be voting online in the next 10 years.
Well, the experiment is coming up during this primary season in Idaho and Arizona. Let's go to Connection listeners and find out what they're saying on this subject. Connection listeners, how much information are you getting on the candidates off the web, if any? 1-800-423-TALK, 1-800-423-8255. Janet joins us from Malone, New York. Hi, Janet.
Hi. I want to say I'm not connected with the internet. I live in a rural area. I have to go about 10 miles to the library, which is connected. Now, you're supposing that a lot of people are connected to the internet. But I don't agree with you. I don't think they are. I get my information from the radio and from newspapers, magazines, and that's the way I vote and what I learn that way.
Is that enough?
For me, it is. My whole life is not going to be connected to the internet. And I think you're supposing that people want that, and I don't.
Well, I think we want to just provide the option for people who want to avail themselves of the technology. You could. You're not saying that you don't have the availability of a computer and an internet connection. If you have a telephone line in your home and you have a few $100 to spend on a computer, then you can do it. It's just a matter of choice for you.
Jacob Weisberg, is there an urban-rural divide on this issue, do you think?
Well, there is a digital divide, both in terms of urban, rural, and in terms of income. But as the price of this technology comes down, I think it's maybe one of those problems that's sort of taking care of itself. The amazing thing to me is, and certainly true, as the caller points out, that there are lots of people on the internet and many who don't have any wish to be. But the amazing thing to me is just how quickly this is all happening. I was one of just two reporters covering the 1996 presidential campaign on the internet at the end. And at that point, people barely knew what the internet was. The idea that the internet was going to be seriously involved in journalism or that it would be a tool for campaigns was considered a fantasy. And this year, and as you point out, in Arizona, the Democratic Party is going to allow online voting. It is happening so quickly. It's astounding. And a lot of people have talked about this campaign as the internet's 1960, referring to the way that television really came of age in the 1960 presidential campaign, particularly with the Kennedy-Nixon debates, which probably were decisive in deciding the election for Kennedy. I think that may be a little premature. I don't know that the internet is going to be a decisive factor in electing this year's president. But if this isn't the net's 1960, it's the net's 1956 or 1958, and the next presidential campaign will be conducted on the internet to a degree that makes even this one look like nothing.
Well, how do you imagine that online voting will change the political landscape?
Well, online voting has the potential, if you believe the people who are so enthusiastic about it, to really change this whole pattern in the country where people don't register and don't vote. As you know, we have the lowest level of participation of any liberal democracy in the world. And the idea that people could register and vote on the internet at least creates the possibility that they'll disappear overnight, and then that you'll have twice as many people voting in elections in the future as vote now.
On the convenience factor alone, perhaps.
I think convenience is the main thing, but it's something in particular that appeals to younger voters who have the lowest rates of participation of any, and they are the most adept with this technology. So I think it's something that points possibly directly at the problem.
Could it bring more fringe candidates and third parties into the fray simply because it'll be more accessible? Information from those groups, from those candidates, will be more accessible?
Absolutely. Well, as you had on the first part of the program, someone working for Donald Trump, who I certainly consider a fringe candidate. But in terms of even fringier candidates, you know, one of the things the net does is that it allows people who have any kind of special interest, including an extreme political interest or an obscure political interest, to find each other all over the country and all over the world. And that's sure, that absolutely, that's not only going to lead to new candidates and entering political campaigns around the country, it's going to lead to improved support for the third party candidates that exist now who might otherwise have very diffuse support, like libertarians, socialists, and so on.
1-800-423-TALK, 1-800-423-8255. Back to Connection listeners. Tom, hi, you're on the line.
Hi, how you doing? Great show. I just wanted to say one thing I'd really like to see on the web more of is independent groups matching up the candidates on their websites so that voters can very quickly get an idea of how the candidates stand on each of the major issues. And then, you know, hypertext links to the speeches that they've given throughout the campaign so you can look up how they stand on very, very specific issues of interest to voters. I'd really like to see more of that.
Tom, if you go to politics.com right now and go to a candidate page, I hate to do this, but it's true. We have a tool that we work with C-SPAN to take all of their footage from the Road to the White House series, and that is searchable by data and by video right on the site politics.com. All the candidates are there. So you can actually do that right now.
Is it searchable by individual issues? I mean,
yes, it's searchable by word.
Uh-huh.
By text, you type in whatever you want to know. Type in, you know, taxes, and it will spit back what they've all said about taxes.
But do you have, Kirk, I think what he might be asking, do you have a side-by-side comparison of all the candidates on all the big
that's
issues?
That's what I'm getting at.
And what this will do for you is will bring up all the candidates that you ask for. You ask for all the candidates, it will tell you side-by-side. You'll have to go and read what they said. But it will give you a comparative basis there.
I think you just got a good suggestion.
1-800-423-TALK, 1-800-423-8255. Tom, thanks for your call and that suggestion. Let's take another now. Eileen, you're on the connection. Hello.
Maybe this would help Tom, too. I would like to mention the Vote Information Services website, www.vis.org. And it's a nonpartisan website, and it creates reports on the members of Congress.
It's a wonderful site. It's wonderful.
Oh, thank you very much. And these reports show how a congressman voted on legislation, and then that is compared to, like, legislation that's important to over 30 special interest groups. So, for instance, you could get a report on John McCain, and then very clearly you could see how he is aligned compared to these special interest groups.
Eileen, are you do you work for that site, or are you just an interested voter who goes searching for information?
I help a bit on it. It's actually my husband's site.
Okay. Let me ask you, Eileen, what is it that you find lacking in the candidates' websites themselves?
Well, I think that there's a lot of good information, but obviously, some of these, you know, Governor Bush has not been a congressman, but Senator McCain, you can go and you can check and see what his voting record is. So you can see what he says versus what he does, which I think is very important.
Well, Eileen, thanks for your call. Thanks for the bit of information. Thanks to your husband for putting together that particular website. 1-800-423-TALK, 1-800-423-8255. Let's bring Stephen to the connection now. Hi, Stephen.
Is this me? Am I on?
Yes, you are, Stephen.
Oh,
go ahead.
Sorry. I was wanted to come back to this issue of the digital divide and the fact that the web currently might be a politically exclusionary tool. In other words, issues of culture and income, I think, exclude a lot of people from the political process, and that certainly currently and probably at least in the near future, I don't think the web is going to move nearly as quickly as was said by one of the commentators earlier, to sort of include a lot of the people who are living at the poverty level in the U.S.
Jacob Weisberg.
Well, I think that was true at some point with all new technology tools. It was true with telephone service, and we needed government help to extend access to that more equitably. It was certainly true with televisions, which were very expensive at first, and it has been true with the net. But I just think the net has a way of solving these problems much more quickly than you think it's going to. And in fact, we're very close to the point now where computers are, if not free, are available free with subscription to certain kinds of internet services. I think that it may, in a couple of years, get to the point where the issue will not be whether people can afford this technology, but do they want it?
Yeah, and I think, you know, those concerns are legitimate. What we can do about it, I think, as Jacob addressed, is just help the technology to catch up. I do, you know, you can go and buy a web TV unit for about $100 down at the department store and hook it up to your telephone line. I think it's more of you got to get people to want to be involved. And I think one of the things about the internet, it's an overused term, but it levels the playing field in many ways. We're talking about parties getting on the web and attracting people with their views that they may not have been able to do before. And I think it is a great thing for democracy in the long run, where people can get on and chat and discuss and place their views on the web. And it's a great marketplace of ideas.
Stephen, thank you for your call. Kurt Ehrenberg. Do you want to weigh in on that, Kurt?
That was me.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought that was Stephen talking.
No, I'm sorry.
My apologies.
Your callers are so intelligent on this program, you can't tell them from the guest.
Let's take another call. 1-800-423-TALK. 1-800-423-8255. Stephen, again, thanks. Bob, you're on the line now from Louisville, Kentucky. Hi there.
Yeah, the lady that called in before was a little bit concerned about not having internet access, but you know, when the telephone was invented, a lot of people were resistive to that, and we have phone booths, so I foresee people being able to go when it comes time to vote. Instead of driving to the polls, they'll be driving somewhere where internet access is available for them to cast their vote. You know, a lot of people are resistive to technological changes, but when you go in the grocery store and you check out, they use lasers, no more cash registers. So the people that don't have these things, I'm sure it'll be made available for them.
Kurt Ehrenberg?
Well, I think it's pretty clear if you look at the way you do your banking these days with an ATM card. If somebody told you 10 years ago you would trust your money to a credit card that you'd slide through to make your deposits and withdraw your money, you might have taken issue with that. Now, I think that's the kind of model we're looking for to vote, is an ATM card type thing, which you'd slide through, and it would know it was you. You'd have a code that matched up to it. You'd be able to vote one time in the election.
Bob, how much information are you getting on the candidates during this election cycle off the web?
Well, I don't usually go to the web for that as much as I do use the TV. I'm a CAD drafter, so I'm on the computer all day long, and whenever I get home, I more or less try to divorce myself from it for a few hours and absorb it through the TV. But I have researched things over the internet, political issues, and, everything that I look for, I pretty much find. I don't have any problems at all.
You know, Bob, if I could just say something here, I think the internet has this magnificent ability to create a problem and create the solution at the same time. And a very good example of that is the talk you're hearing now, all the concerns being raised about the AOL Time Warner merger. And is this going to curtail our sources of information and mean that a few big media companies control what everybody thinks? Now, I guess there's some legitimate concerns there in terms of consolidation of media organizations, although I never really thought of the AOL as part of the news media before. But at the same time, the net is allowing the creation of all of these independent voices of all kinds, from the chat rooms to personal websites. You know, there's a guy, one of the sites that's been kind of interesting in this campaign is this guy called Zach Exley, who started a site called gwbush.com. He registered that domain name and infuriated the Bush campaign because that was one he got to first. And he's just a citizen. He's a guy who thinks, doesn't like George Bush very much. He thinks he's a hypocrite on the drug issue because he thinks that he probably used drugs at some point in the past. And this guy maintains this very impressive site which is basically about making this political point. And what he is a kind of journalist, but he's a journalist who doesn't really get paid, doesn't really cost him anything to be a journalist. It's his hobby. And so at the same time that you have these huge consolidations, you have all of this stuff bubbling up at the grassroots all over the country.
That's right. And his website caused George Bush to say there should be limits to freedom, which the quote, you hear that quote around every now and then. And I think Zach is one of the people who promotes that quote on his site. But it provoked George Bush to say that, which becomes part of the campaign.
Well, you're raising an issue, though, that raises the hair on the back of necks of traditional journalists, and that is, who is a journalist on the web? What are his or her credentials? What's the background? What's the experience? What's the point of view that that person or that particular group, which is responsible for that website, is trying to pursue? And I'd like both of you to comment, if you would, on whether or not you think it's a good thing or a bad thing that in going directly to websites, voters will be able to bypass traditional filters, the news media, the League of Women Voters, whatever.
Well, I was a traditional journalist until a couple of years ago, Bob. I worked for Newsweek and New York Magazine and a lot of other places. And I have to say, this doesn't raise the hackles on the back of my neck or otherwise at all. I think it's a terrific thing that anybody can be a journalist in a way. Now, what you have to do if you're a user and you don't consider yourself a journalist on the Internet is you do have to be more discriminating about what your sources of information are. And you have to take things with a grain of salt and not assume that because it's in effect printed on a page that it has some sort of credibility. But I think making citizens more savvy consumers of media and of journalism is useful anyway, because you know what? Not everything you read on a printed page in the so-called traditional established media is worth believing either.
Well, I can attest to that, because being from New Hampshire, where for most of my life the main newspaper was run by a lunatic named William Loeb, you know, the traditional media really doesn't have any more of a hold on the truth at this point than the Internet. I think it's the buyer beware. And just like if you're picking up a pamphlet in the off of someone on the street corner who's speaking on a soapbox or something like that, look at it closely and make sure you know who's putting it out. But the medium is not the villain here.
Let's bring one more Connectionite to the line before we end the show. Dennis, you're on the Connection. Hi, and thanks for calling.
Hi, how are you? I made use of the Internet just recently to volunteer on several campaigns from the protest perspective. We, like a lot of us, were out in Seattle, use the Internet to mobilize and educate. We also are now focusing on the New Hampshire primary. And so I signed up as a volunteer on the Gore campaign at Al Gore 2000. And then a couple days, they called me up and said, you know, it's great that you're a volunteer. We need to mobilize people for a rally, which was on Saturday. So I got some like-minded protesters together, and they were very specific. They're like, you know, you're a volunteer. You have to round up people and give us their names to make sure they get in. So it's kind of a staged rally, very faux theatrical event to present the illusion of mass support for Al Gore in New Hampshire. And there were people from, you know, flown in from all over the country to pack this high school gym. So we were joined the crowd and went in and managed to provoke a small disruption of his speech. And it was pretty much through the use of the Internet that it facilitated our access to that controlled you know, we had our names checked off and brought our kind of clandestine signage past all the Secret Service. And so really want to thank the Gore people for having such a useful website. And to reiterate what you said before, Gore and Bush are very sneaky about revealing their whereabouts and their schedule, because they're aware that there are people who
Dennis?
Want to bring alternate messages out there. And Bill Bradley essentially spams us with his updated schedule.
Dennis, I need to interrupt because the program's coming to an end. Thank you so much for speaking about your experiences about web campaigning on The Connection today. Thanks as well to our guest, Jacob Weisberg, political correspondent for Slate, Kurt Ehrenberg, managing editor at politics.com. Thanks also to Phil Madsen, webmaster for Trump and former webmaster for Jesse Ventura. I'm Bob Oakes. This is The Connection from WBUR in Boston.
Cassettes of The Connection are available for $15, including shipping and handling. To order, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287.
Funding for The Connection comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and from the Alaire Corporation. PRI, Public Radio International. From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Brookline Booksmith, presenting Pantheon author Ha Jin, reading from his National Book Award-winning novel, Waiting, on January 18th at 7 p.m. Information at 5-6-